Today's episode features two extraordinary portfolio managers, our CEO Caroline Kai in conversation with our founder Rich Pezina during our recent 2024 Mid-Year Global Outlook for Value webinar, hosted by Director of Business Development and Client Services, Kate Phillips. This podcast is presented by Pezina Investment Management, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, and is intended for institutional investors only. The views expressed reflect the current views of Pezina as of the date hereof and are subject to change. There is no guarantee that any projection, forecast, or opinion in this material will be realized. Past performance is not indicative of future results. In the UK, this podcast is for professional clients only. This marketing communication is presented by Pezina Investment Management Limited, which is an appointed representative of Vittoria & Partners LLP. Vittoria & Partners LLP is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
All right, I think we can get started. Welcome to Pezina's Mid-Year Outlook webinar. I'm Kate Phillips, and I'm responsible for our intermediary relationships in the Midwest, and I'm joined by my two colleagues, Caroline Kai and Rich Pezina. Thank you all for joining us today. The format of today's webinar will start with prepared comments, followed by a Q&A session. Many of you have submitted your questions during the registration process, but I'd also like to remind everyone that you can submit your questions at any time during the webinar in the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. There are many of you that know us well, but for those that may not be as familiar, I'd like to start off with a brief introduction of Pezina. We are global deep value investors, and as of June 30th, we manage over $64 billion in assets under management. We have one philosophy and one investment process across all of our investment strategies. For the nearly 30 years we've been in business, we've maintained our discipline to our value philosophy investment process across all market cycles. We have a 30-person investment team, all located in our New York headquarters, dedicated to our investment research. I have two of those members joining me today for the call. Rich Pezina is, of course, our founder, our co-chief investment officer, focused on our domestic strategies, and he's also a portfolio manager on our large cap value and U.S. best ideas portfolios. Also joining us today is Caroline Kai. She's our CEO and portfolio manager on our global, international, and emerging market strategies. Thank you both for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Kate.
So why don't we get started with you, Caroline, if you don't mind, and just putting the first half of the year into perspective, as value has had a really tough time. Maybe let's start there.
Sure. So if you actually look at the performance for the various markets around the world in the first half, equity market actually did fairly well across all the major regions, right? The annualized return of the first half, whether you're looking at value indices or the general indices or growth indices, it's in line, I would say, was what most investors would expect from the from equity market, if not materially better. Now, in that context, value stocks generated good returns but underperformed the growth in all major regions of the world, as you can see on this table. The underperformance in a global context was quite extreme at over 1,000 basis points over the course of 6 months. And this level of underperformance, it's not unprecedented in the history of market, but it's fairly rare. When we go back and look at the long-term history, you know, under 5% of the time periods, can you find this degree of divergence between value and growth? And then if you look at kind of what really drove that, it's primarily a U.S. phenomenon. Yes, value stocks underperformed growth in sort of the developed and emerging market countries, but that the level of divergence is much more modest versus what you see in the U.S. And I think of it as somewhat in the range of what happens over a relatively short time period, in this case a 6 months time period, right? But if you look at the U.S., you know, the U.S. megatech names really drove the disparity in performance, both on a global basis and within the U.S. These seven stocks returned 47% on average in the first 6 months. And if you look at the U.S. market specifically, that's almost three quarters of the difference. So coming back to your first question, It was actually a good period for equity market as a whole and value stocks too, but it felt terrible unless you were in the growthy part of the market, right?
And Rich, maybe, you know, if you don't mind speaking to the disparity in the U.S.
Well, that kind of disparity of 1,000 basis points or more is really rare. And if you think about it in the last, in the context of what we remember in our investment lives, obviously it's a repeat of last year where the Mag 7 or the rough equivalent of those had a similar performance. We had it during COVID, and then you have to go back to the internet bubble to find the last time that you had it. But to put some perspective on all of this, what's really interesting is that just like we, like Caroline said about the performance of value in the first half, the performance of value during the last decade, where most people come to the conclusion that value is just a bad place to be, it's actually the same performance that value has exhibited over the last 100 years in the United States. So if I went back 100 years and just naively picked the cheapest stocks, I would have earned about 11.3% a year over that 100-year period. And over the last 10 years, value's earned 11.1%. So value is actually behaving quite normally. It's the other side that has deviated dramatically, not only in this quarter, but really during the last 10 years. And so if you just use the metric of expensive stocks and say the cheapest stocks were up 11.3% a year over the last 100 years, the most expensive stocks were up around 9% over the same 100-year period. And over the last 10 years, they were up 14.5%. So really the deviation is occurring in these in a small number of companies showing up in the growth index. And that's very out of line with history.
And Rich, in our quarterly newsletter that we released earlier this week, we talk about the extreme disparity in the performance between the cap-weighted and the equal-weighted indices. Can you talk us through that as well?
Sure. And if you can just put that slide up. Over the last, I think it's the same 100-year period, although I won't swear to that, but over the 100-year period, the number of times that you actually saw a very large discrepancy of the order of magnitude of 10% between a value and a growth index, there were 15 six-month periods out of a lot of rolling periods during that period of time. And actually, equally weighted portfolios outperformed cap-weighted portfolios by a total of about 1.5% a year, or an average of 1.5% a year over that long period. Now, when that has happened in the past, when you've had these extreme outperformance periods like the one we just witnessed in the last 6 months, the bounce back for equally weighted portfolios and more importantly for value portfolios has been quite extreme. As you can see from this chart here, the average 1 year return for equally weighted stocks was more than 1,000 basis points ahead in the year after one of these underperformance periods. And the 5 year return compounded at 1,000 basis points a year. And when you look at value, it's been even more extreme. And maybe we have a little hint of that in the first 2 weeks of the third quarter, because we're already seeing some of that today, although you don't want to draw any conclusions from that other than that observation.
And just as a follow-up question to that, so it sounds like the market concentration is leading to these anomalies, but is there anything else driving the recent performance?
Well, I think Well, Caroline, did you want to jump in on that one?
Rich, you can start.
Really, when we look at our own performance, small changes in earnings expectations had led to kind of outsized impact on investment performance. And the companies that have been delivering this growth and have continued to deliver the growth had outsized positive expectation, positive performance. So, you know, it's interesting because when we look at our own and we try to do our own self-analysis, the misses have been relatively minor and not indicative of something that you would consider long-term issues with the companies. And yet the reaction had been large. And I think part of the reason for that is if it's true that reactions are excessive, and there's nothing of consequence impacting the companies in the long run, you get the rebound. And that's what I think we're observing here.
And maybe Caroline, if you could touch on the non-US perspective.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we see fairly similar development outside the US, you know, specifically to what Rich referenced, outsized share price reaction in response to very modest earnings change. Now, I think part of that comes to when we're buying a deep value stock, there is uncertainty and lack of visibility in the near-term direction of travel for the company. And what we lean on as long-term investors is our understanding of how this business will evolve and improve over time, right? So, but if the market feels uncertain, you know, and the company has small earnings misses, it gets extrapolated, and you're seeing fairly extreme behavior in this market. Just take one example in the in our non-U.S. portfolios, Daimler Truck, kind of a manufacturer of heavy-duty and medium-duty trucks. Really was operations around the world, a lot of earnings coming from North America. So even though it's a German company, it's not just tied to European macro conditions. The stock was down about 20% in the second quarter of this year, even though the earnings revision that you could see from the sell side collectively was roughly, I think, in the 3% range. So fairly big disparity between the share price reaction and the really the even the near-term earnings prospect for the company. Now, our reaction to Rich's point is you kind of go back and see what's changing about your long-term view of the business. And what we liked about Daimler, which is the, you know, a true leader in the business that operates on a global basis, lots of self-help opportunities in their North American business, improving the mix, but also across the world, improving the sort of the fixed cost, structural cost position of the company. Yes, there's quite a bit of uncertainty on what the demand may be for heavy duty trucks in the short term, but over the long run, we see a company that has the ability to really improve its long-term prospects through self-help and trading at very low valuations. So when the stock actually incidentally moved up quite a bit in the first quarter in reaction to modest improvement in the earnings forecast, and we trimmed our position at that time, but with the pullback in the second quarter, we've been adding to the position again, really looking at that long-term multiple, long-term price to normal as a guide for what we do and trying to take advantage of what's going on in the short term. Now, one thing I do want to add to sort of what Rich was saying earlier is one thing I think is a little bit different in the non-US markets is the US macro is doing fairly well outside kind of pockets of weakness that we've seen, such as low-income consumers, for example. But if you look around the world, there are actually a lot of different places that are in a lot of pain, right? India is doing really well, but China, for reasons that everybody knows, going through a real estate downturn, having real geopolitical issues, The macros is doing quite poorly. And in Europe, the war in Ukraine, even though it feels like it's been going on for a while, you know, we're still seeing the long-term impact of the war playing out in Europe, and then the snap election in France. All that is really to say there are lots of places where we see companies already experiencing earnings pain because of the macro conditions. But what we're looking to is how companies are reacting to it and how they're looking to go through restructuring self-help to improve the long-term earnings. And we're able to pick them off at a relatively low point of their earnings cycle and a low valuation too.
Rich, maybe speaking to the US portfolios, any opportunities that you find particularly exciting at this time?
The way I would describe the value environment in the US is fairly normal. There's been some extremes in history where, and using the metrics that we generally use, which is price to normal earnings, where stocks get really, really cheap. And really, really cheap, I'm going to say, in the order of 5 times the long-term sustainable level of earnings that a company can generate. That happened in our history as an investor 3 times. It happened during the tech bubble, where Western manufacturing businesses all moved to be around 5 times earnings. And that happened for a couple of reasons. One is there was an ongoing shift to low-cost manufacturing out of the United States, where at the time, Taiwanese companies could produce the same products for 30-40% less than the Western manufacturers were producing them for. And then the growth of the internet enabled a go-to-market strategy for these companies. And so people thought they were going out of business, and they valued them as if they were going out of business, and obviously put very, very high valuations and expectations on the companies that were leading this change, the internet bubble. And the interesting part is that when you met the companies that were running, the CEOs of the companies that were running these businesses, they would say exactly the opposite. They were not fearful of going out of business. They thought they were going to hold on to their business in spite of all of this. And the story went something like this. People buy our products because we have 100-year history of quality and reliability and service. And we have our sales force is embedded in their plants, and we can service something. And the idea that somebody would switch to a distant competitor to save a little money and risk that the plant goes down was not going to happen. And if it turned out that still was a risk, we can make our products somewhere else as well. There's no strategic advantage. So we bought all these things. And then what happened? What happened was they didn't lose their business. And the internet bubble reversed, and there was this big boom in manufacturing. Then we had it in the financial crisis, when obviously financial services companies hit a really big wall for good reason. And the valuations imploded also, and you could buy again at 5 times normal earnings power. And then we had the same thing happen in COVID, where you could buy for 5 times earnings. Now, when I look at our 30-year history in business, we've ranged from 5 times at the extremes to 10 times at the high end of the range. And we're right in the middle of the range right now. So the opportunity set for a pure value investor, a traditional value investor, looks quite normal and in line with the returns that we've achieved. The future returns look in line with the returns that that we've achieved in the last 10 years and that the data suggests you could have achieved over the last 100 years. So I would describe this as normal. The extreme today in the world is probably China, which Caroline's probably better suited to talk about, but that's where you see five times normal today.
Yes, you know, the issue in China is obvious to everyone, and we did go into quite a bit depth on what we see as the opportunity set in China, given that, you know, in a lot of our non-US portfolios, from emerging market to international to global, we have been increasing our exposure to China as a whole, given the valuation. Now, in the second quarter, you know, the Chinese market actually rebounded along with the rest of the EM on hopes of macro improvement. We see fairly significant challenges in China from the macro standpoint, but that's really what created the condition for extremely low valuations in the Chinese market and the opportunity to own some phenomenal franchises at the type of valuations that Rich is talking about, that, you know, you only see at extreme points of pessimism, even from a value standpoint. So one of the things that we always loved about China, I would say, is the diversity of businesses that one can expose oneself to. There are close to, you know, there are over 600 companies in the MSCI EM, Chinese companies in the MSCI EM index. And that's more than the total of the next four biggest markets combined: India, South Korea, Taiwan, and Brazil. And you can find over 80% of the industries within the MSCI world in China. And in contrast, if you look at Taiwan, which accounts for, you know, it's about 75% of the China market in size, but only has about 30% of the industries of the world represented. So a much more concentrated set of businesses that you can potentially pick from. And with all investing, you know, a company's domicile is not the same as its business mix. And one of the things that's always interesting about China is they're great domestically focused franchises, but you can also find a lot of businesses that are truly global leaders, but their valuations are under pressure because of the China domicile and the portion of the exposure to China. So Higher Smart Home, one of the holdings that we have in both our emerging market and international products, is a global leader in major appliances. So washing machines, refrigerators, cooking things, and air conditioning. Over half of the revenue is actually generated outside China for Hara. So it's domiciled in China, but a true global business. They acquired a GE appliance business back in 2016. So if anybody is buying GE or Jenner products, you're really buying a higher product at the end of the day. And they have, you know, they have invested into products, distribution, brands since the acquisition, and has really turned around the performance of the GE appliance business here in North America, gaining market share consistently and improving earnings over time. In Europe, in contrast, they have been loss-making in recent years and are in the process of kind of a turnaround. Then in China, where people are worried about the impact of the real estate market slowdown, you know, one of the good things about major appliances, it's really heavily tied to the replacement market. There is impact from the real estate slowdown, but not as dramatic as people may expect. And on top of that, they've done a really good job moving the mix up market and improving earnings at the same time. So when you look at Hara, there are multiple different ways of winning. Really, at the end of the day, we don't need the Chinese market or the Chinese housing market to recover for Hara to generate better earnings over time. And that's really the type of opportunities that we're looking for and finding in China today.
And Rich, you know, finally, with our prepared comments before we move into the Q&A, what about a stock in the U.S. that we've recently added?
So I'll talk a little bit about Humana. Humana is an HMO, that is primarily in the Medicare Advantage business. And it's a good example because it's very, very typical of the kind of company that we would invest in that you would say is deeply undervalued. For those of you who are not familiar with how Medicare Advantage works, when you reach Medicare age, you're faced with the choice of, do I just take the traditional government plan, or do I choose one of the supplemental plans that are offered? And more and more people have been choosing to take a supplemental plan for one very simple reason. Over the course of your life as a traditional Medicare beneficiary, you have co-pays and deductibles. And if you get very, very ill and you have to cover 20% of the cost of your illness, it could be devastating. So over the last 25 years, Medicare Advantage, really your choices are to buy a supplemental plan, which is a Medigap plan, which is very expensive. And when you're 65 and still generally relatively healthy and have to make these choices, it seems like something that is very costly to pay into to eliminate that risk. Or you can take a Medicare Advantage plan, which doesn't cost you anything. What you agree to is to restrict the network of doctors and healthcare providers that you use in a managed care kind of way, which for the most part people have become accustomed to because that's the nature of corporate provided health insurance plans in America. And so the population today of Medicare Advantage is about 50% of all Medicare patients. They've chosen it because it eliminates the copay and deductible. It costs them nothing. And they're used to dealing with someone that's going to adjudicate their benefits. So this had been a growth business for many, many years. First of all, the Medicare population is growing because of age demographics and medical costs are going up, and the percentage of people choosing Medicare Advantage is going up. So people like this. COVID messed everything up. During COVID, older people didn't go to the doctor or didn't have procedures done because they were afraid. And so the margin skyrocketed. And being a competitive industry, in order to achieve more share, really to grow share, these companies enhanced their benefits. So adding coverage, adding gym memberships, for example, to attract more business. And they misjudged how rapidly the Medicare patients would come back into the market. And they came back with a vengeance in the last 18 months, squeezing their margins dramatically. And Humana stock fell by almost half from its high. And so it obviously popped up on our screens, because if you actually believe this is a good product, that they will be able to rejigger, and they're really not locked in. Every year they can re-create their benefit package. And the only option that they have really is to cut back on the benefits. And so the risk of that is that will piss off some of their existing customers or slow the growth rate. And there's a lot of concern. That's why the stock went down. But if you simply assume that they could get back if you assume they could get back to their historical margin structure in this business, even ignoring the couple of years of superior results, it's a home run. So this is the kind of thing we like to buy.
So maybe switching gears, let's start the Q&A session. I have a number of questions that were previously submitted, but just as a reminder to everyone, feel free to ask your questions in the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen here. Starting off with the first one, the U.S. markets have long outperformed both European and Asian markets. Do you expect that to continue for the next few years?
I'll take that one, Kate. So, you know, if you've invested, put any money outside the U.S. market, when you go back and look at the 10-year return, it feels pretty bad, right? EM, IFA, you know, return about 4% during this period, whereas the Russell 1000 actually returned 12.5% over the last 10 years. Now, I think it's important to kind of go through what were some of the drivers of the difference in performance. So the Magnificent Seven, which is a somewhat of a unique U.S. Phenomenon. Yes, there are mega tech successful tech companies outside the U.S. like TSMC, ASML, but nothing of the level of concentration and scale as what we see here in the U.S. market. If you take out the Mag 7 from the U.S. returns over the last 10 years, that's close to 3 points of it. So it goes down from 12.5 to a little over 10%, I think, maybe around 10%. And then the dollar, which has had a big impact on returns over long cycles in equity markets, and sometimes it's a headwind for non-US markets, sometimes it's a tailwind. We have been in a fairly long period of dollar appreciation versus most major currencies. But if you go back and look at the history, you know, from 2002 to 2007, where the developed non-US markets outperformed the US market, for example, I think over 40% of that returns can be accounted for weakness in the US dollar. Whereas if you look at the relative performance since then, you know, close to half of the outperformance actually can be accounted for by the US dollar's strength. So you cannot throw out things that worked and say, well, look at what's left and there's no difference. That's not the point. The point is just to say, you know, it's important to understand some of the drivers in what's led to the 12.5% in the relative difference over time. And on the dollar, when no macro specialists, we're not here to forecast long-term development, but to have the same level of difference in to have that 50% of the performance differential to be repeated, one kind of has to forecast the same degree of dollar strength versus what's observed over the last 15 years or so. Maybe that'll happen, but that's a pretty significant assumption, especially when you look at kind of where the dollar stands from a purchasing power parity perspective versus the major currencies. And then, you know, we talked quite a bit about sort of the Mag 7 and their gravitational pull around sort of market returns over time. You know, at the end of the day, we don't know if things will turn around next year or the next couple of years. But one thing I do think is important to highlight again is we're not really trying to buy markets. You know, we're believers in buying businesses. And the most important thing for us and the value added that we do is really understanding what a company's underlying earnings are exposed to. And do we see a path towards improvement and pay as low of a price as a starting point as possible so that we have good embedded expected returns over time.
Great. Thank you, Caroline. Rich, this looks like a question for you. How would you compare the current environment to the tech bubble and other bubbles?
It's pretty similar. It's you know, you hear a lot of commentary that dismisses the internet bubble as a unusual bubble, that there weren't real businesses in there, that it was just complete craziness. But there were real businesses in there, and they dominated the performance. So the first company in history to hit $500 billion. We think of that as kind of boring today, $500 billion, but Cisco was one of those companies. And Cisco was the backbone. It was all the hardware that was going to enable the internet. And it had a $500 billion market cap and earned, I think, at its peak, $1 or $2 billion, or at its peak then, not subsequent to that. The amazing part, though, is that when you started to try to do the arithmetic on Cisco, could you ever justify a $500 billion valuation? It would be very tough to do, because to make the kinds of returns people were expecting back then, which were, I would say, 15% a year, Cisco would have to earn $75 billion a year, and the earnings of the entire telecommunications and sector that they were focusing on didn't have any chance of ever earning $75 billion. So, you know, we see the same kind of stuff now. I'll just use Microsoft as a simple example here, because NVIDIA is the obvious one to use, but it's harder to do the arithmetic on. But people look at Microsoft and say, this is a real business. It's got a lot of earnings. It's trading at 35 or 40 times earnings. It's not like what Cisco was. But what people are excited about in Microsoft is not the dominant portion of what their earnings are. Microsoft and Microsoft's business still is skewed towards Windows and Office, and then on revenues. And then when you look at it from a margin perspective, those are even higher margin businesses. So I don't know, 70% of their earnings come from things that are not, they're growing, but they're growing in line with, you know, global technology spend. They're not the exciting part of cloud and enabling artificial intelligence and building all of these data centers. So when you actually try to do the arithmetic on Microsoft to say, what growth rate do I have to believe in order to get, and now we wouldn't even use 15, we would use a 10% return. The numbers are staggering. So for example, in our arithmetic, our simple arithmetic, the cloud business would have to grow 20% a year for 20 years. And it is growing at or more than 20%, so it doesn't sound like an outrageous number. It's just that when you compound that for 20 years and you look at the historical trends of what overall global tech spend has been and are likely to be, that would imply that in 20 years, cloud spend would exceed 100% of global tech spend. So that's an impossibility, obviously. So either the arithmetic is wrong or global tech spend will be substantially higher. But we always have to remember that somebody has to write the checks. It's not just the excitement about the technology. And so while it could happen, what people are doing is betting on extremely, extremely optimistic views that they extend for very long periods, extrapolate for very long periods of time to justify a valuation. So very, very similar to Cisco.
Thank you, Rich. Next question is, what are expected or implied 10-year returns for a deep value strategy versus expected implied 10-year returns for the S&P 500 based on starting valuations?
Well, I'll give you the answer in the US, because you want to compare it to the S&P. The expected return that we see is in the low double digits, so 10 to 12, something like that, because you're buying high free cash flow yields, currently high, call it mid to high single digits, and GDP-like growth. And that gets you, that's the arithmetic. And so our portfolios, as we measure them, are 7.5 or 8 times normal earnings, which is effectively a low double-digit return. When you try to do the same arithmetic on the S&P, and then remember that's an aggregate look at the economy, because long-term S&P 500 earnings have grown at or around GDP, nominal GDP, and you're dealing with high valuations, so the current free cash flow yields are low, you're hard pressed to come up with numbers that are much better than mid single digit returns. So there's a big spread.
We have time for probably one or two more questions here. Is the case for investing in value centered around the dispersion between value and growth, or are there stronger fundamentals appearing in value names? Is it a factor story or an individual idiosyncratic stock set of stories?
I can jump in, Caroline, unless you want to take this.
Go ahead. I'll...
You'll add on.
Yes.
You know, we have on our website a saying that value is a philosophy, not a factor. So I strongly believe that. We are looking at individual companies where the share prices have become depressed because something has gone on that's made people scared or that's demonstrating that something's wrong, and the valuations go down. That's what we do. So there's nothing unusual about the entry point valuations. There's nothing unusual about the types of companies that we're finding. There's nothing unusual about the circumstances that they find themselves in, similar to the way I described Humana. And they're reacting the way companies always react, which is a problem arises and they do their best to fix it. Doesn't guarantee that they're going to fix it, but they're trying. On average, they do. And that's what leads to the returns. So I'm not sure, maybe I didn't totally understand the question, but I think value works as a philosophy because these are human behavioral issues and it requires research and understanding the businesses, not because of something that's going to happen on interest rates or GDP growth, or these things are generally uncorrelated to long-term investment performance. They're correlated to short-term investment performance. And I don't know how to answer that question in the short term, but in the long term, I don't see anything undermining value.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, okay. If I can just add a point to what Rich was saying, and I think it goes back to some of the questions earlier. You know, Rich laid out a case, I think a very compelling case around how the arithmetic has to work for Microsoft for the valuations to. For the stocks to perform, given the starting point of valuation and what's already embedded in expectation, you know, one of the things we see and why I think some of the environment is a little extreme at the moment is the excitement around AI. The same excitement around how the internet was going to be very disruptive to businesses. It was going to be sort of the next industrial revolution, right, going back to 2000. I can't remember who wrote this. I mean, I thought it was an interesting thought. So when you think about kind of railroads going back to earlier periods of industrial revolutions, kind of transformational forces in the wider economy, the reality is there were a lot of railroad investors or businesses that failed in the early days. The winners were few and far between at the end of the day. It did become very important over time, but there were a lot of sort of, there weren't that many winners coming out of it. And I think that's what the growth guys are focused on figuring out, right, who the winners are. And perhaps at the moment, there's expectation of a lot of winners. Now, we as value people are always on the other side of it, which is everybody looks around and says everything else that's not railroad is just the canal. Is, you know, the horse carts and so forth, and that creates opportunities. But if you're really looking at the company, trying to understand how it makes money, same as what Rich mentioned earlier, how these industrial businesses adapted itself to a labor force, sort of labor supply disruption, and AI could be similar in that fashion, right? Kind of changing what requires human labor to perform. It's different in the form, but in some ways the substances are fairly similar. I apologize, there's a lot of traffic going on, siren activities in the background.
No, thank you, Caroline. And actually, my last question was on AI, so you touched it perfectly. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have today. I want to thank Rich and Caroline for joining me for the discussion, and also all of you for tuning in. If we didn't get a chance to get to your question, please feel free to reach out to your regular Pazina contact or email us at info@pazina.com. Thank you all, and have a great rest of the day. Goodbye.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Pazina Perspectives. If you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. And for more insights on value investing, visit our website at www.pazina.com. That's www.pzena.com.